Welcome to the Endless Knot Podcast,
where the more we know,
the more we want to find out,
tracing serendipitous connections through our lives
and across disciplines.
Hi, I'm Avon.
And I'm Mark.
And tonight we're going to be talking to you about runes. After a fair amount of stuff we want to get through first.
Right.
Because the very first thing we have to say is, if you're listening to this far in the future, that's an optimistic thought, Mark, isn't it? We are recording this right at the very end of March 2020, the longest month I have ever lived through. And we're at home, as many people are, because of the coronavirus, COVID-19. And so I just feel like we have to address that at the beginning of this.
But, you know, one thing you can do when you're, you know, locked up in your house is record a podcast.
Yep. So we're finally getting to it, though. You might think we'd have all the time in the world to do that now. But because both of us are teachers at a university which went online with less than 24 hours notice on March 12th, I believe, the last few weeks have been pretty nonstop for us. Mm-hmm. We just sort of had to turn around and put all our classes suddenly remote. We had no warning. So anyway, that's fine. You know, we both are at least accustomed to online things. That helped. Mm-hmm. But it's been pretty busy. And the kids have been home since 2 days after that for March break. And then for the last 2 weeks. And we now have been told they'll be home for another month, which is totally to be expected. And frankly, I don't think they're going back this year. So that's also added to our life. So anyway, we're fine. We're good. We're healthy.
We have lots of things to make cocktails. So
yeah, lots of things to make cocktails with. A couple of our local businesses are doing deliveries and no touch pickups and things. So we've done that, but we've been pretty much staying at home. We've gone out only for groceries and booze. And for the last, it's almost 3 weeks now, eh?
It's as long as that. Wow.
Well, this Wednesday will be 3 weeks from the day classes were canceled. And I guess we went out sort of Thursday and Friday for various things, but that week.
Time loses all meaning.
I know. It really
it's
feels
either
like
it's been like a year since we
this all happened
or like yesterday.
Yeah. So anyway, so we haven't had tons and tons of time. We finally got a video out, which took us forever and ever to do, but we finally got that out. Now we're doing the podcast. I would love to say that because of all this, we're going to be doing more podcast episodes more quickly. I don't think that's going to be true. This is the last week of term, but we have exams to get through, which are now take home exams, and it's all very complicated. So it's going to be a little while before things slow down for us.
Yeah.
And goodness knows what the world will look like in a week or 2 weeks. Things are changing so quickly. Anyway, we really hope everybody out there is safe and well, surviving being locked down or having to work if you do, doing whatever you do. If you're working at the many jobs that are frontline in various different ways, thank you. If you're not and you're not working, I'm sorry. And if you're at home, slowly losing your mind, I'm sorry about that too. I hope this can at least distract you for a bit, because we are not going to be talking about disease. I did briefly think about
doing an episode
on medieval disease or something, but we decided no. We're just going to go ahead with what we were planning to do, which is talk about runes and a video that we did on runes quite a while ago. So maybe this will give you some distraction. So enough. I don't think there's anything else we have to say about that. Patreon. We have a couple of new Patreon supporters to thank, Jordan Mackey and Corey from 12 Tone. That's a YouTube channel that if you have not seen, you should check out. The Music Theory.
Thank you, both of you. Mm-hmm. And yes, do check out 12 Tone. It's one of my favorite channels.
Mm-hmm. Related to that, however, is we are going to, as I said, this is the 31st of March, and we decided this afternoon, we're going to pause our Patreon, I don't know exactly what it's called, the donations or whatever, like pause the charging for at least for April and maybe the next couple of months. As I said, because we're teachers, our jobs haven't been affected and we're very lucky that way. And while the money from the Patreon does definitely help us with the costs that come from servers and services and various other things related to doing the videos and the podcasts, we are in a position to absorb that cost for a little while. And we just don't want to add to the costs of so many people who might not be able to right now, even a dollar or two or $5 a month. You know, that can matter if you suddenly don't have a job. So we're going to pause it. If you are a Patreon supporter and you still do have some financial stability, we'd love it if you took that couple of dollars and gave it to another creator, maybe. There's a lot of creators who do depend on their Patreon money or other kinds of, you know, who do creation full time and for whom it's really tough. Or to, you know, give it to a charity or give money to somebody who can use it. Don't, of course, if you don't want to. But, you know, that's one of the things we thought people might be able to do.
Mm-hmm.
And we'll give notice on the Patreon site before we turn it back on. So you will know you're going to be charged for the next month.
Our other big announcement is about the launch of an app and group.
Yeah. Community app and platform, I mm-hmm. guess.
Yep. Called Lyceum. And what it is it's a platform all about educational podcasting. And so there are a whole bunch of really fantastic educational podcasts on this new platform, including us.
Mm-hmm.
And it's really set up so that, you know, people who are particularly interested in educational podcasts can find the stuff they want to find the creators they want to find,
mm-hmm.
And interact with those podcasts. Just a nice little home for yeah. people who are, you know, really into that sort of thing.
They're doing things like putting together collections of themed podcasts on different mm-hmm. topics or on larger subjects. They're going to continue to do that. So this is a launch of a beta version of the app. Like, there's still going to be more development with it, but they're doing sort of collections. That's on the app itself. There's discussion forums for each show. They're definitely focused on sort of recommendations from creators for other creators.
Mm-hmm.
And they are, you know, hand curating and checking out the shows that they are putting on the app. So it's not just anyone who applies.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, they're also definitely not focused on, you know, only big shows,
yep.
or we wouldn't be on there. But they're focused on shows that are good and thoughtful and give the kind of educational experience that people are looking for.
Yeah.
So it's lyceum.fm, that's lyceum.fm is the website. Right now, most of the functionality is only on the app, but you can learn about it on the website. And I think they are planning to make it available on desktop eventually.
There's going
to
be a web app
mm-hmm.
Eventually. So,
but it's not there yet. But yeah, so if you go check us out there, we do have a discussion post posted. I mean, there's not a lot of discussion yet. It only launched a couple of days ago. But do feel free to talk to us there or just go and take a look at the various shows that are there. If you are yourself a podcast creator, there's also on the website, there's information for applying to be on the app. And I would encourage it because one of the things that there is from the back end that's so good for us and that we really like is that they're developing a community of creators. So there's a place for creators to talk and, you know, share ideas and problems and ask for advice and discuss the sorts of things that podcast creators care about that maybe nobody who's not a podcast creator cares about. And we have, you know, we have that community with videos with We Create EDU,
mm-hmm.
and it's been so special and important to us. And to be able to start developing that community with podcasters, it's really nice.
Yeah.
So that's something, if you are a podcast creator, that I would definitely recommend.
Absolutely. And by the way, we will try to post, you know, some sort of points for discussion or mm-hmm. questions on our forum there.
Mm-hmm.
So head over there and, you know, join in the conversation.
Mm-hmm. So Lyceum, check that out. All right. I think we're on to cocktail.
Yes. So since the topic today is runes, which, you know, are an important part of Germanic culture, and in particular, the Northern Germanic, the Scandinavian mm-hmm. cultures, we decided to look for a cocktail that was somehow sort of Viking-y.
Well, we looked for runes, but there was nothing. So then we looked for Vikings. And we found a cocktail that is sort of Viking-y.
It has Viking in the name.
It does. But I think in the end, it ended up being very appropriate because it's completely made up. It started with the name and worked backward.
Yeah.
I mean, all cocktails are made up. I understand that. But this is one that has like no authenticity, no claim to it at all. And as I think you'll discuss a little bit when you talk a bit. The runes and sort of Viking culture have kind of suffered from that, and the use of runes in the modern world of people starting from that and sort of backfilling it with a story has no authenticity.
It became very occulty in the 19th century with no direct connection to
actual historical practice. Yeah. So I think there's a meta way in which this is. So would you like to tell us the story of this cocktail?
Well, for those of you old enough to remember, there was a television show called Cheers.
Mark said to me when he was talking about that, he's suggesting this cocktail, he said, did you ever hear of a show called Cheers? I nearly slapped him. I was like, what do you think I am?
She hardly watched television as a child. There's a lot of shows she doesn't know.
Yeah, but I mean, who doesn't know Cheers? Well, I'm not, unless you are younger, but I'm in my 40s. I know Cheers. Anyway, yes. So the show Cheers.
Well, there was a joke on this show in which to get the bartender Woody his job back, because they had another sort of very professional
hotshot bartender. Yeah.
And so to sink this other guy, they sort of formed this scheme in which everyone would like come in and ask for this made up cocktail, and he wouldn't know how to make it, but Woody's in on it. So he would know, you know, he would pretend to know what this cocktail was. Mm-hmm. And that cocktail was called the Screaming Viking.
So, of course, in the show, they don't explain what it is.
No.
But
the only thing they mention is the only ingredient.
Cucumber.
Bruised cucumbers. Yeah.
But people have, of course, gone ahead and made up a cocktail.
Yes.
So we went and found on Spruce Eats a cocktail recipe for it. So we are drinking a Screaming Viking.
Yes. Now, part of the joke was they all then pretended to drink whatever crazy concoction that he made, and they sort of didn't swallow. And as soon as the guy walked out of the room, they all spit it out. So
it's not good. But we'll see how this is. So cheers.
Well, it's not that bad.
No. I mean, I knew what went into it. It couldn't be that bad. So all it is vodka, dry vermouth, and lime juice, and garnished with a cucumber and a cucumber spear and a celery stick. Mm-hmm. And ours have been sitting, because we were prepping this for so long, for quite a while. So it actually tastes quite a lot of cucumber.
Yeah, and it has the nose of the cucumber.
It's very tart. Mm-hmm. There's no sweetness to it. But so we're having the Screaming Viking. Mm-hmm. The Viking part of which has clearly no connection to anything actually Viking, but it still amused us. And perfectly tasty.
But it's a good joke on crazy cocktail names, I suppose.
It is that too.
Because, you know, they do sometimes have
ridiculous names
like that. So,
all right. So what are we going to be listening to and then talking about, Mark?
Well, this was originally from a video that we did quite a while ago. And it was a collaboration with another YouTube channel called Native Lang. For the record, this was just before Native Lang went viral.
Exploded. With his hot Latin video.
Yeah.
I still love the fact that that's what took him viral. It was Latin. Never took me viral, but that's okay.
So we did this as a kind of two-parter in which Native Lang did a video. His video was entitled Muslim Vikings and Magic Letters, The Odd History of Runes, Part 1. And then my video was Guns, Thorns, and Smartphones, The Odd History of Runes, Part 2. So basically, Native Lang talks about kind of the origin of the runes, or some possibly apocryphal story, but the origin of the rune.
And cheese.
And some general facts about the runic alphabets. And then I talked about the runes as they're used in England, and then the later history of the runes after the Middle Ages and through all that kind of occult stuff and whatnot.
So what we'll do now is listen to the voiceover for that video and then come back. And I think you have some more things you want to talk about after that. And we've got some discussion about early writing systems and the history of early writing.
And we'll also include in the show notes a link to Native Lang's video.
Oh, of course, yeah.
So you can go and
check it out. Very fun. You should definitely see it.
The runic system that was used in Anglo-Saxon England and Scandinavia before the arrival of Christian missionaries was rarely employed for writing extended texts, mainly just inscriptions and such like. Once the missionaries arrived, though, it didn't take long for the new converts to come up with the idea of using the Latin alphabet for writing down not just Latin, but also their own language. Just one problem. Or maybe a couple, actually. There were some sounds in the various Germanic languages that just didn't exist in Latin, so there were no letters to use to write them down. For instance, both the voice th, as in modern English either, and the voiceless th, as in ether, didn't exist in Latin, though a similar sound from ancient Greek was represented as th in Latin contexts. In early Old English manuscripts, the sound was represented as the digraph, that's two letters together making one sound, th, or simply as the letter d, but eventually a diacritic stroke was added to that letter d to differentiate it from a regular letter d to make a symbol we now refer to as eth. And a little later, another solution to this missing sound also began to be used. One of those old runic characters, the thorn, as it was called in Anglo-Saxon, or thurs, meaning giant or ogre, in Old Norse. You see, though the runic writing system is an alphabet representing sounds, not an ideographic system, the characters have meaningful names. These two characters, either eth or the runic thorn, could be used for either th or th. Old Norse manuscripts followed suit with first the letter thorn, and a little later the eth, with the added twist that thorn came to be used only as the initial letter in words, and eth in other positions, whereas in Old English, the letters were used interchangeably. Another runic character was pressed into service as well, the win, meaning joy, to represent the w sound. In Latin, the letter u was used for both the vowel u and the consonant w. Actually, in the earlier Old English manuscripts, the letter u was used for w. But eventually, to avoid confusion between the vowel u and the consonant u, the runic win was adopted. Of course, to our modern eyes, the runic win looks an awful lot like the letter p, so modern printed editions of Old English texts replace all the wins with our modern w, a character that came about a little later by joining up two v's or two u's, the double u. But if you're reading actual manuscripts from the period, you have to mind your p's and, well, wins. Actually, we're kind of prone to mixing up those old runic characters and Roman letters. That's what happened with those ye olde shop signs, in fact. You see, the thorn hung around for a while after the Old English period, gradually becoming less and less common, and as it did so, the form of the character became less and less distinct, with the ascender, that perpendicular line on the side, becoming shorter. So the thorn looked more like the win, which by the 14th century had disappeared, and like the p. Confusing. And by the 15th century, it looked a lot like the letter Y, so that when the printing press came along, printers would often use the Y in place of thorn, though by that point, the th digraph had mostly replaced it, with the thorn being used in common words like the, often represented in text as Y standing in for thorn with a superscript E. So what looks like Y-E, ye, was actually thorn-E, the. So it should really be pronounced the old shop. But that's not nearly so quaint. One last way that runes were worked into English back in those old Anglo-Saxon manuscripts was as a type of secret code. A few individual rune signs were dropped into the otherwise Latin script, which would be put together to spell out the answer to a riddle or the name of the author, as in this poem by Cynewulf. It's no coincidence that runes were used in this secretive way, since rune itself is not only Old English for runic character, but also meant secret or mystery, and counsel or consultation. It comes via Proto-Germanic, probably from an Indo-European root meaning roar or murmur, which also gives us the words rumor, riot, and raucous. The word mostly faded from the language along with the runes themselves after the Anglo-Saxon period, only to be added back in by scholars in the 17th century and later who were studying those old runes. But there is at least one hidden remnant of the word in the place name Runnymede. You see, Runnymede in Surrey was where Anglo-Saxon kings held council meetings with their various nobles, aldermen, thanes, and so forth. Remember the council meeting of rune? The so-called Witena Jamot, literally meeting of the wise men, which, by the way, inspired J.K. Rowling's Council of Wizards, the Wizengamot. So Runnymede literally means Rune Island Meadow, and it's therefore appropriate that in the year 1215, the feudal barons of England, who were, I suppose, raucous and ready to riot, buttonholed King John and forced him to accept the Magna Carta, which limited the powers of the tyrannical king. Not that he kept to his agreement, but rescinded it shortly afterwards. Nevertheless, Magna Carta marks an important milestone in constitutional history. Getting back to those runes themselves, for the most part, their use faded with the Middle Ages, but they were later revived with Gothicism and the interest in the ancient Germanic past in the 18th and 19th century. This is a factor in the growing nationalism of German Romanticism, which celebrated, and to some degree fabricated, a romanticized version of Germanic history, of which runes were a part. Furthermore, the runes fed into the esoteric and occultist fascination of figures such as Austrian mysticist Guido von Liszt, who developed the Armenian runes, and inspired by them, Carl Maria Villigut, who developed his own version of the runes in the 20th century. And that's the next link in our chain, because this was exactly the sort of thing that caught the interest of the Nazi occultists, particularly Heinrich Himmler, who incorporated these runes into various Nazi insignia, most famously the insignia of the Schutzstaffel, the so-called SS. Another script-related thing that the Nazis were into, at least at first, was the old black letter or fracture typeface, which had developed from the Gothic manuscript hands of the later Middle Ages, and which by the 19th century had become particularly associated with Germanic culture and language. The Nazis eventually decided to dump the fracture typeface in favor of the Roman script, claiming, mendaciously, anti-Semitic reasons, but actually because it made practical sense to use the same typeface as the rest of the Latin alphabet-using world. The Nazis weren't the only ones to favor the fractured typeface. Many writers in the 19th and early 20th century expressed similar attachment to the script for German nationalist reasons, such as German type designer Rudolf Koch. In addition to typefaces, Koch was also interested in other graphic symbols, such as the old Germanic runes, and published a book on various old symbols, monograms, and runes called The Book of Signs. This book brought many of these old symbols and runes to pop culture notice, including to the attention of rock band Led Zeppelin, who used a couple of the symbols from the book on the cover of their fourth album, which were meant to represent the band members. The one that drummer John Bonham selected was three circles, meant to symbolize two parents and a child. It also happens to be similar, though flipped upside down, to the company logo of the 400-year-old German industrial Krupp family dynasty, known for steelworks, and for, believe it or not, a German heavy metal band called Die Krupps, who called themselves after this old German family name. The company logo is actually based on the seamless railway wheels the company manufactured, but lest you think this is all a bit of a tangential connection, the Krupp family ties into our story in another way. You see, the company manufactured weapons for World War II, for which they got into some trouble due to their forced labor practices, as well as for World War I, during which they built the famous heavy gun called Big Bertha, named after, if you'll believe it, Krupp family member and heiress Bertha Krupp. Actually, there's a long history of giving guns women's names, such as Mons Meg at Edinburgh Castle, and also, it seems, the very first gun, so to speak. At least that's where the word gun comes from. A particular 14th century canon at Windsor Castle called Domina Gunhilda, or Lady Gunhilda. Gunhilda is an old Scandinavian name, the two parts Gunnar and Hildr both meaning battle, and both names of Valkyries, the warrior goddesses who collect the souls of the slain warriors from the battlefield in Norse mythology. As the Oxford English Dictionary points out, there weren't any notable women in England at the time by that name, so likely the use of the name for large munitions, before gunpowder and cannons, they be ballistas or other large siege weapons, goes back to Scandinavian times. Perhaps after someone like Gunhilda, daughter of Harald Bluetooth. She and her husband were apparently killed in the St. Brice's Day Massacre in 1002, when all the Danes in England were ordered killed by King Athelred the Unready, in retaliation for which her brother Swain Forkbeard retook England, which Harald Bluetooth had held before Athelred, bringing it back under Scandinavian control. And speaking of Harald Bluetooth, that's where we get the term for the wireless short-range communication technology that you probably have in your smartphone. You see, Harald was also known for uniting the warring Danish tribes into a single unified kingdom. In fact, the Jellings runestone I've used as the background for this video was raised by Harald to commemorate his unification of Denmark and Norway. And on that basis, Swedish telecommunications company Ericsson picked his name for a technology that was intended to unify the, at the time, disorganized communications protocols, uniting them into one standard. Oh, and the symbol for that unifying technology? It's based on the runic symbols for the initials of Harald Bluetooth. So hopefully we'll try and post a few images of some of those runes in our show notes, at least the ones we mentioned specifically, and maybe one overall picture of the whole alphabet, just so you get a sense of what they look like. Because describing letter forms in a podcast works great.
Yeah, it works better in the video where there's images.
So I want to talk a little bit more about the runes and their development.
Mm-hmm.
So the runes are an alphabetic writing system.
Right.
Like the Latin alphabet that we use in English today. It's known as the Futhark or Futhork. Futhark in other Scandinavian places, Futhork in England because of sound changes that happen.
Because the English are weird.
Well, because because of a sound change that happened to that particular vowel.
I like my explanation better.
And the reason it's called the Futhark or Futhork is from the first six characters written in order. Right. So it's like A, B, C, D, E. If you write them in order, it spells out the first six characters, spells out that word, Futhark. And so that's what they were called.
And it's not a word otherwise.
It's not a word otherwise. Yeah. So it's like saying the ABCs or something.
Or the alphabet.
Or the alphabet. That too. Good point. Yeah.
The alphabet named after alpha, beta.
Yeah.
First two letters of the Greek alphabet.
Yes.
Sorry.
Yes. Which will come up in a later episode.
Yeah, we'll
episode,
get to it. So, yeah. Well, later today.
Well, later today as well. Yes.
Bit, yeah.
So the earliest runic inscriptions date from around 150 CE. Mm-hmm. How much before that they existed is hard to say. Mm-hmm. The earliest complete Futhark, so like the whole alphabet written out, is from the 4th century.
Okay, it's pretty early.
Mm-hmm. Now, there are several different versions of the Futhark. It sort of changed over time, and I'm not going to necessarily mention all of them, but I'm going to mention the main ones that were used in the early period. They're later sort of medieval runes, so after the year 1000. So the earliest Futhark was the Elder Futhark. Mm-hmm. That was used from around 150 or earlier, who knows, to around 800 CE.
And these names are later historical names, right?
Yes. Yeah.
Elder is just meaning the older one, the earlier one.
Yeah. Now that Futhark consisted of 24 runes, which were often arranged in three groups of eight.
Okay.
And from that developed the Old English Futhork, which was used from at least around 400 to 1100 CE. And those were used, as I say, specifically in England. So they represented some of the sound changes that
were
happened
in England.
Right. So it's therefore an expanded set of 29 and later 33 runes to account for those phonological changes that happened, including the development of diphthongs. There are a lot of diphthongs in Old English compared to other Germanic languages at that time anyways.
Okay.
And so they needed characters for those. Another development from the Elder Futhark is the Younger Futhark. Big surprise. That was used.
It's the great creativity in naming systems that's always impressive about scholars.
So that was used from around 800 to around 1100 CE, and it was first attested in Danish inscriptions, and so I guess spread from Denmark to other parts of the Scandinavian world. It is a reduced form of the Elder Futhark. It only has 16 runes, which is surprising. You'd think normally letters might be added, but no, this was specifically simplified, I think, is the idea. And
to
so
make it easier to learn to write.
Exactly. Right. And so certain letters do double duty. So it's a pared down writing system. Now, the largest group of surviving runic inscriptions are in the Younger Futhark, which I suppose is not surprising. And specifically from the Viking Age in Denmark and Sweden on runestones, which is the thing you would expect to survive. Right. There are obviously other artifacts that do have.
Yeah, we'll get into that when you do what's the earliest English word.
So, you know, there's things like combs. I think I mentioned one in that video. And, you know, other sort of more perishable materials would be inscribed with runes, but, you know, they don't tend to survive as much. So there were later runes, as I say, used in Scandinavian places through the later part of the Middle Ages, and even as late as around 1800.
Like used for actual communication and record keeping?
Or for decorative purposes or for various other reasons. I don't know how much.
Well, that's what I wondered.
Yeah. There are runic manuscripts. I don't know if there's any that date that late. But there are runic manuscripts produced in later periods.
Okay, so interesting.
So exactly where and when the runes were developed and from what earlier alphabet is a matter of much debate. There is so much written on this, and most of it is written in Danish.
So how's that a problem, Mark?
my comprehension of Danish is not great. I can manage modern Icelandic if I need to. Danish is harder.
Yeah, fair enough.
But yeah, so there are a number of competing kind of theories. Some of the older theories about the origins of runes is one, it came from the Latin alphabet.
Right.
Or two, it came from the Greek alphabet by the Goths on the north coast of the Black Sea. Mm-hmm. But with some Latin letter. There are obviously some letters that aren't Greek, so they must have come from Latin.
Okay.
Or from Etruscan or other North Italian alphabets.
Right, okay.
And in fact, the symbols seem to most closely resemble the North Italian alphabets, though there is no single alphabet that we have that has all of the runic symbols in it.
Hmm, that's interesting.
So it may just be that it didn't survive, or... So we can't pin it down to a specific alphabet.
Right, right. And there's so much interaction because, like, when you're talking about Germans, mm-hmm. there are Germans, broadly speaking, yeah. all along the sort of northern yeah. parts where they could have interacted with any of these groups.
They were used in mercenary forces yeah. for the Romans.
So there's no particular trade. Well, and long before they were mercenaries, they were fighting them and yeah. trading with them. So yeah, there's like so many points of possible contact that yeah. you can't really pin it down. Makes sense.
But it's generally now accepted to be from an old Italic script. So I don't think anyone's championing the Greek
or Etruscan
hypothesis anymore. But of course, even there is, you know, it's uncertain which particular variant. Mm-hmm.
Yeah,
that
only really narrows it down. It does not yeah. pin it down. Yeah.
So some possible sources include the Rhytic.
These are just all, everything you're going to name is almost certainly just going to be an early group that was yeah. then subsumed by the Romans.
By the Romans. Exactly. So they were in the north of Italy. Yeah. That geographically, I suppose, makes sense. Mm-hmm. The Venetic, who mm-hmm. are from the northeast, that's where modern day Venice is. Mm-hmm. The Etruscans, who were in central Italy, so a little further down.
Yeah, just north of Rome.
Yeah, where modern-day Tuscany is. Mm-hmm. Or Old Latin, which obviously is centered on Rome. But of course, later on, as Rome gained control of other parts of the peninsula, the alphabet went with them. Mm-hmm. So depending on when.
Yeah, well, exactly when this transition yeah. happens, yeah.
And there are various arguments in favor of each of these options. So you could say, oh, well, this one has so many symbols that correspond, or, you know.
Right. The shapes of these are more. Shape.
Yeah. So it's, everyone has their argument, it seems. And
you're in no position to judge between them. Yeah.
I'm not an expert on this. So the process of transmission is also greatly debated. Mm. The oldest inscriptions we have are in Denmark and northern Germany, but that may not be where they were first used, right? Those are just okay. the earliest surviving ones.
Yeah, of course.
So there's a West Germanic hypothesis that suggested it happened in the area around the Elbe River. Mm-hmm. Or there's a Gothic hypothesis that it was in the East and it happened along with the Eastern Germanic expansion. Mm-hmm. So who knows? But if it's early enough, and it seems to be, I mean, in the first and second century CE, the sort of Common Germanic language had not yet branched off into its three right. major branches, East Germanic, West Germanic, and North Germanic.
Right.
Which is not to say that the languages they Hadn't spoke already. Was all uniform, mm-hmm. but they were not so differentiated yet. They were still all...
So they may well have been mixing, yeah.
Yeah. So it's even difficult to make that argument on phonological grounds, right? Mm-hmm. Because they're phonologically mm-hmm. all kind of the
so
same.
So there's no easy way to distinguish yeah. them, yeah.
What we can say, interestingly, I suppose, is... We can look at the order of the runes in the Futhark. Mm-hmm. So at first glance, you might think, well, Futhark, A, B, C, D, E, F. I mean,
F-U-T-H-A-R-K. Yeah,
it doesn't yeah. look related at all.
Yeah.
But actually, there is evidence of the relationship between the order in the Futhark and the alphabet. So first of all, the F rune, that first rune, mm-hmm. looks very similar to the A rune.
Okay, you're wearing a shirt with runes on it right now. So rather than call up the runes, just show me. All right. F-rune? When you say looks similar to A, what A you rune. Mean by the, oh, the A rune, I was going to say, it does not look at all like A.
No.
Yes, okay. No, the F rune, so yeah, the F rune sort of is angled, it's like the bars on the F are angled upward, whereas the A rune, the bars on the F are angled downward.
Exactly.
Okay.
Yeah. And so what might have happened is they flipped positions.
So it started point. With an A.
It started with an A, like the alphabet does.
Just not an A that looks like an A.
Well, if you consider
you can
what,
make it and, kind of end yeah. up looking like an
and
A.
And if you
yeah.
look at early alphabets. Italic alphabets, they don't look That's, exactly yeah. like the
yeah, same
later.
With early Greek ones. Yeah. yeah.
Anyways, mm-hmm. so if you flip those two, then Futhark gives you the order A-U-T-H-F-R-K. Doesn't help, but we've got an A first. Now, the B rune and the U rune may have also exchanged places because this is a phonological thing. So
the B rune looks like a B.
Yes.
And the U rune looks like an N with a slanty top.
Yeah.
Like a triangular N, yeah. But with a, like a, yeah.
Now, they don't look similar. All that similar, yeah. But phonologically, what may have happened here is that B was more like a W sound. And so B, if you flip those two, because B is more of a B, it's made with the lips rounded.
Mm-hmm.
And so the two sounds are phonologically similar.
Okay.
They may have flipped places, in which case you get the B rune as second.
Mm.
So now we've got A and B.
Okay.
And it also puts the U after T.
Right.
T-U instead of S-T-B.
I'm going to take a picture of this when we're done so I can post your shirt, which you got in Iceland.
That's true. Yep.
So it's very exciting.
Now, as for the thorn, the third character in the Fudark, well, that phonetically, we can say, is related to D. And in fact,
That one I'll give you.
Yeah.
You don't have to explain that. Well, I mean, you can explain if you want, but
they're both dental sounds. They're articulated in the same way.
And
indeed, you know, as I talked about in the video,
one
D
another.
With a slash through it made the TH sound as well. Mm-hmm. So therefore, that thorn may have originally represented a D. And so you get that in the next position, right?
Mm-hmm.
Which is where you would expect a D.
Doesn't look all that dissimilar to a D, right? Mm-hmm. Like a capital D. It's just that the side, the upright, extends to either side beyond the...
Yeah, you can say it looks a bit like a delta in particular,
yeah.
If you think about it that way. Though I always thought that the thorn rune kind of looked like a thorn, right? That may be a later rationalization. Who knows? The E rune, which confusingly looks exactly like an M, is right next to the M rune, which looks like an M. If you can describe it.
Yeah, an M that's wearing a bow tie. So the top where my hand gestures aren't helping. where the angles, if you think about it, a capital M and how there's an angle line. Imagine both of the angle lines going from the top all the way to the other upright.
Yeah. So
they meet
and then keep going.
And they keep going instead of just making a V in the middle.
So
that's what I mean by the bow tie. You have two like triangles facing one another with the sides on the uprights on the other sides.
So that E rune may have been located elsewhere in the order.
And then moved because the two look so similar.
So we could then potentially reconstruct the position of the E near the beginning of the alphabet where it ought to be. Then later on in the Futhark, we have the sequence P-Z-S-T.
Yes, right.
Now, that sort of looks similar to the alphabetic order, right? Except for the one letter in there that sort of breaks the order. So that Z looks out of place, though. Where did that Z come from? There was another sound change that happened in early Germanic in which the Z became, the Z sound, that is to say, became an R sound. Which eventually led to there being two R's. So in later Futharks, there are two characters that make the R sound. Though in transcription, they followed the usual practice of transcribing one of them as a capital R and the other one as a lowercase r, just because to represent the fact that they came from two different sources. They're originally two different sounds.
Okay.
So if you do that, though, if that Z turns to an R, then suddenly we have P-R-S-T.
Yeah. Okay.
So,
I feel like the amount of special pleading going on here, because each one of these is like a different mechanism, right?
Yeah,
that's the problem behind all of this.
That is maybe the problem behind this. Yeah. But in any case, it gives us an order that looks a lot more like alphabetical order. If we adjust all of those, we get A, B, D, E, F, and then that other R, and then the K, C.
Right.
Which is really from a kappa, I guess.
Mm-hmm.
And then later on, P, R, S, T, U. So that's the argument.
But none of that helps you narrow down which italic script it comes from, though.
Well, it seems to be similar to Western Greek and Old Italic. So that's, you know, pretty much all we can say for certain. And actually, most of that was
not certain in the slightest.
What I can say with somewhat more certainty is the geographic spread of runic inscriptions.
Okay.
So the farthest north and the farthest west is the... try and pronounce this because it's a sort of Greenlandic word. Kingatorsuaq.
Mm.
Kingatorsuaq runestone.
Okay, I'm going to guess that's in Greenland.
Yep. And by the way, before anyone writes in, no, the furthest west is not the Kensington runestone.
Right, that's the one in like Minnesota or whatever. Yeah.
It's not real. It's a hoax.
Sorry.
Right.
So yeah, so Greenland, the farthest, both the farthest north and the farthest west.
Okay.
And that inscription says something along the lines of, well, I won't try reading it out in Norse because I'll probably butcher it at this point. I'm really out of practice. But it says, Erlingr, the son of Sigvaths and Barne, Thordar's son, and Enri the Aus son, washing day, which is my favorite.
Saturday.
Yeah. Saturday is my favorite day of the week in Norse. Washing day, before Rogation day, raised this mound and rode, and then you can't read the rest.
Rode,
R-O-D-E?
R-O-D-E. Okay. When you're talking about Scandinavian people, it could be the R-O-W-E-D.
Yes, right.
All right. So it's a marker stone or a monument stone. Yeah. And it's within the Christian period.
Yes, because they mentioned Rogation Day. Mm-hmm. Yeah. The farthest east is the Barazun runestone, which was found on Barazun Island, which is on the Black Sea.
Okay.
And it says, Granny made this vault in memory of Carl, his partner. Granny is not like grandmother.
Yeah, I was totally thinking it was.
G-R-A-N-I.
What an odd thing to write. Not even grandmother, but just Granny. G-R-A-N-I.
Okay. Yes.
It's a vault, like a tomb, basically.
I guess, probably, yeah. And just looking at it now, the word for partner is falaga, which is fellow, literally.
Fellow. Right.
The furthest south is the inscription on a marble lion from Athens.
Ah, yes.
The Piraeus lion. Which is now no longer in Athens. It's on display in Venice because of Romans, I guess.
Right. Well, at least it's Romans, not English. Yes. I thought you were going to say the British Museum, but No.
It's in Venice. So this is presumably pilfered a long time ago. And it says something along the lines of, they cut him down in the midst of his forces, but in the harbor, the men cut runes by the sea in memory of Horsey, a good warrior. That's his name, Horsey, though it probably does mean horse. The Swedes set this on the lion. So we know it's Swedes who did it, I guess. He went his way with good counsel. Gold he won in his travels. The warrior cut names, hewed them in an ornamental scroll. Askel, or Auskel, Iskel, depending on how you read it, and others. So this is probably something that doesn't show. And Thorleifr had them well cut. They who lived in Roslagen. And then there are two bits that aren't represented, but they seem to follow the formula of name.
Mm-hmm.
So name, son of name, cut these runes. Ulver and name, colored them in memory of Horsey. He won gold in his travels.
That's a long inscription.
Yeah.
Huh. To put on something that wasn't purpose made for it. That's long graffiti is really what I'm trying to say. Especially given how much of it is just saying, I wrote this.
Yes. Well, that's what most of the runic inscriptions basically say that. And this is the best example of this. So this is the next one. There's also a runic inscription in Constantinople.
Right, which is also fairly famous. Isn't this the one that Native Lang talks about?
Yeah. So it's in the Hagia Sophia or Hagia Sophia, depending on how you pronounce it. There are, in fact, two inscriptions that have been found, and it's speculated there actually may be more that just haven't been discovered yet.
Oh, okay.
But they haven't fared as well, so they're not easily legible. One of them probably said, the only thing that can be read at this point, I think, is four letters, F-D-A-N, but it probably said Halfdan.
Okay.
And the rest is not legible, but it's speculated to mean something like Halfdan carved these runes. So literally, they traveled all that way to Constantinople, went into
like,
a church, and graffitied it with, Kilroy was here.
I think a church is an understatement for Hagia Sophia, but...
There's another one that is also pretty much illegible, but may have said something like Ari made or Ari made the runes. I think there's like one letter there that can maybe read.
Right. And then they've guessed the rest of it. Yeah. But mostly because that's clearly what everybody just went around doing is writing I was here.
Exactly. So, you know, apparently there's a lot of that going on in the Hagia Sophia. And the other interesting thing about the geographical spread of runic inscriptions is that though runes are mentioned frequently in the sagas, Iceland has the fewest inscriptions of all the Scandinavian
Even though they
countries.
Talk about it all the time.
Yeah, so not that many in Iceland. But, you know, kind of the interesting point to take away from that is that the mention of the runes in Iceland are the ones that seem to describe mostly the magical use of runes.
Right.
And so that brings me to my next topic, runes and magic.
Mm-hmm.
So the connection between the runes and magic is much debated.
Another very securely discussed thing. Yeah, I
know. Runology is all like crazy.
All made up stuff. It's what you say.
Yeah.
It's all made wild up. There is no truth.
It's this crazy wild west of scholarly debate. Yeah, there was, I think, some famous quote that, you know, there are as many interpretations of a runic inscription as there are runologists who
looked
at it.
Yeah.
Yeah. That's really what it's like. And, you know, to be a runologist, you have to either be, you know, really credulous or really skeptical.
Right. To be able to make an argument of any sort.
Yeah. You can just say, it probably means nothing. Or you get two letters and somehow reproduce a long poem out of it. I don't know. But the question is, are runes magical in and of themselves, or are they just a script?
A way of writing a spell.
Which could be used for magical purposes, right? We don't think of the Latin alphabet as magical, but it was used in spells.
Except for when we have the abracadabra, but...
Yes, right.
But that's not quite just the alphabet. It's still magical words.
Yeah. And so it's really hard to judge, and it's also just because it's, you know, maybe quite likely used for magic in one place doesn't mean that it was used for that in another place.
Mm-hmm.
So you can't assume consistency over the entire Germanic regions.
Right.
One way of thinking of, I mean, you can look at the objects themselves and make judgments about what the object is. And is it likely to be something that was used for a magical purpose? You know, is it an amulet for protection, but how do you know? Or is it just written on a comb? That's not going to be magical, presumably. There's also sort of arguments you can make by looking at the inscriptions themselves, what they're written on, how they might be used. But the other way of thinking about this is, of course, the semantics of the word rune itself, which is what I talked about in that video. So to just expand on that a little bit, the Gothic word runa glosses Greek mysterion and occasionally boule, which means council.
Mm-hmm.
And they're commonly used, these, because our Gothic stuff is all Christian, biblical translation. So they're used to refer to the divine mysteries.
Okay. So, which means sort of hidden things of great, you know, that you have to have special knowledge to know, which would definitely parallel the idea of magic. But on the other hand, literacy is in itself a mystery. I mean, in none of these periods were people like massively literate at all levels, right? So writing is a mystery.
And
that doesn't have to make it magical. It just can be a good parallel. So,
but of course, the New Testament really has this, what is it? It's the famous quote.
There's a few famous quotes from the New Testament. So you're not really logos, pinning it down.
The Logos one.
The word in the beginning was the word and the word was with God.
Yeah. So the word itself has a kind of, and that's true of all the way that the religions of the book kind of
function
is that there is something sacred about
words.
Words, right?
Some words, all words, something about
Bibles
words.
Bibles in themselves are sacred or holy. They have this sort of power. Mm-hmm. So, I don't know. Who knows? But that's one bit of evidence
Okay.
There's also another Gothic word, garuni, which is just runi with the ga prefix or the g prefix that you find in all the Germanic languages, which means, is used to mean consultation or counsel, perhaps with the idea of secrecy.
Okay.
In Old High German, you get the same two words, basically runa and giruni, with similar meanings.
Mm-hmm.
In Old Norse, the plural form runar is sometimes used to mean secret lore or mysteries, and there are related verb forms to it that mean whisper.
Okay.
Old Irish has a cognate, and this is the only seeming cognate for this.
Old Irish. Now, that's not Germanic.
I know. Yeah, okay. So this is the only seeming cognate outside of the Germanic languages.
Right.
Rune, which means secret. There's also a Finnish word, runo, which is probably an early borrowing from Germanic.
Right. Yeah, never liked a Finnish figure.
And it means song and perhaps originally incantation.
Right.
So it goes from incantation to song.
But I mean, that is an absolutely standard Indo-European. I know Finns aren't Indo-European, but right, song and spell are the same word in lots of languages.
So the sense, if looking at all this data, the sense shift may have kind of gone in this way, from originally secret to secret meeting to whisper to secret formula
to incantation, to charm, and then by way of the tradition of Germanic lot casting, in which runes seem to have been used, cryptic symbol and rune.
Okay.
So it originally just meant secret, not referring to the writing specifically.
Right, and then that became used to refer to the writing because writing is secret. Yeah. Right. Okay.
Now I mentioned the Germanic lot casting that seems to have been used.
Yeah. Runes.
And so again, this is one of these arguments that's based on kind of slim evidence, but or questionable evidence anyways. But there is, of course, an account of early Germanic peoples by the Roman author Tacitus. Of course, we don't have, since they were only writing inscriptions and not long
text,
so
we don't have a lot of
textual evidence about Germanic people until much later, until after they were Christianized generally. But we do have this account written by Tacitus, and he writes in his Germania, which is his ethnographic work on the Germanic people. At one point he writes, "Augury and divination by lot no people practice more diligently. The use of the lots is simple. A little bough is lopped off a fruit-bearing tree and cut into small pieces. These are distinguished by certain marks." Mm-hmm. Nota is the word he uses.
Right.
"And thrown carelessly and at random over a white garment. In public questions, the priest of the particular state, in private, the father of the family, invokes the gods, and with his eyes towards heaven, takes up each piece three times, and finds in them a meaning according to the mark previously impressed on them." Mm-hmm. Now, we don't know that these are runes. We don't know that it's even writing. It could just be symbols.
Or it could be like slashes for numbers, right?
Yeah, I mean, it could be anything. But some have argued that this is an account of the using of runes in the casting of lots, in magical purpose, and suggesting.
But that still doesn't mean that runes are in and of themselves magical.
No, I suppose
because,
it doesn't.
Because, yeah. I mean, if you put letters, like tarot cards have letters on them, but letters are still not magical. Mm-hmm. So, yeah.
So, of course, as I say, we don't know whether or not this means that runes were magical at all places. Mm-hmm. Certainly the evidence of the Icelandic sagas suggests that they thought of them in magical ways. But so this leaves the question, were runes magical in England? And the evidence of magical runes in England is very slight. Basically, there's two possible references. And they're both about the same story, one taken from the other. So Bede tells this story of a young man named Imma, who had been taken prisoner but could not be fettered because the fetters became miraculously loosened every time they, I think it was every time they celebrated the mass.
Okay.
They just pop off.
Because he was so holy.
Yeah. But they, his captors, thought it might be magic, and they asked him, quote, "whether he knew the releasing rune and had about him the staves written out." So in Latin, that would be quare ligare non posset an forte literas solutoris, solutorias. Mm-hmm. The words in the Old English translation of Bede is alessendlican runa. So loosening rune, it seems to me, though there's some textual debate about this. There are different readings in different manuscripts.
Okay.
So this is only in one manuscript, I think. And the other word, stavas, staves, literally, if he had them written, the staves written. So stave is used in, or staff, is used in Old English to mean letter. Like you could refer to a Latin letter as much as anything else.
Right.
So it is definitely a word, word used to refer to individual letters. And then Alfrich later on refers to this passage from Bede, and he uses it in one of his homilies. And his version of the same story is that they ask him whether he broke his bonds asunder by means of sorcery of rune staves. And the word there is literally runestavum, rune staves.
Right.
So this sort of implies maybe something magical.
Yeah. Yeah. But again, it doesn't imply necessarily that the runes themselves are magical. That's closer, though. That seems more convincing to me.
But that's it. I mean,
all of them.
That's what you're basing your whole argument there for England.
Right.
So who knows? And since I'm talking about runes, I want to mention my favorite runic inscription, which is actually the most numerous inscription.
I remember this one.
Written in the Elder Futhark from the 3rd to 8th centuries. And even occasionally in England, not as often, not nearly as often, but very common outside of England. It's the most common, as I say, of early runic charm words. It's the word alu, which
on the face of it, looks like the word ale.
Right.
Now, the origin and meaning of this, of course, is highly disputed, yet again. It's generally taken as some kind of runic magic, but is it the word ale? Is it some other meaning? It's really hard to say, because usually
it's just written, bother just have that, like, why? Yeah,
it's just that one word.
Why would
right?
you?
How can you tell?
And but also, why would you, if it does mean ale, why would you?
Write ale on an amulet.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, who knows? So it may be ale in the sense of an intoxicating beverage, which sort of seems magical, the idea of intoxication. Mm-hmm. Though other meanings have been suggested, like it might mean amulet, and there's a word that's close enough to it that might be that, or protect. But again,
nobody knows.
So it's been posited that it might come from a proposed Indo-European root, alu, which might mean, or the sort of definition for this, according to Cal Watkins, is in words related to sorcery, magic, possession, and intoxication, mm-hmm. or according to the Pokorny dictionary, mm-hmm. bitter or beer. And so this bitter sense might be related, therefore, to alum in Latin, alum, and therefore also aluminum.
Right.
So the bitterness might be the ultimate sense. Again, I don't know why that would
make sense. I mean, medicinal, things that are bitter are often medicinal, but that doesn't make sense for why you describe it places.
That might make sense for beer, I suppose. Anyways, the other interesting point of that, though, is that in Beowulf, there is a passage in which grief or terror is described with the word ealu shawin, which means pouring out of ale, or at least it seems to mean that literally. It's kind of hard to interpret, but so it has some kind of force, right?
Right.
Some sort of meaning beyond.
Some sort of metaphorical or emotional force, yeah.
And of course, just because I like this etymology, the word bridle also comes from the word ale there, specifically in its
bridal,
beer
sense. Bridal,
D-A-L.
To do with brides.
To do with brides. Like a.
Not bridal as in a horse.
No, not bridal as in a horse. It's literally from bride plus ale. And in Old English, it meant wedding feast. So ale in the sense of the feast. Now, the etymology of bride, by the way, is uncertain. There is a Gothic cognate, brudhs, which means daughter-in-law. But that actually kind of makes sense because the newly married woman in any household is going to be the daughter-in-law if you look at it from a certain perspective, right?
Yeah.
And so therefore that bride part might be connected with we don't know where that comes from, as I said, but it might be connected through this logic to the Proto-Indo-European root breu, which means to boil, bubble, effervesce, burn, with derivatives referring to cooking and brewing, as it would be the daughter-in-law's job to do the cooking and brewing. Mm-hmm. So it could mean beer, therefore.
right.
Bride and ale. Bridal means beer. or beer ale. I don't know. Anyways, I kind of like that.
Nice. Yeah.
Now I just have a couple of last little tiny things to mention that aren't specifically, well, actually just one last thing to mention that isn't specifically runes, but it is another early Germanic writing system. Mm-hmm. And that's the Gothic alphabet. So I mentioned the Gothic language and, you know, we have
you talked about
and a few words from Gothic. And as I say, this was basically used by, probably invented by Bishop Wulfila, who was, you know, a bishop and missionary to convert the Goths to Christianity. And so he used them in his biblical translations produced in the 4th century. Mm-hmm. And it was believed that Wulfila consciously chose not to use the runic alphabet for translating the Bible into Gothic because of their association with pagan and magic things and so forth. So the letters themselves, therefore, are mostly directly from the Greek alphabet. They're pretty recognizable as Greek. With a few extra letters to represent sounds that Greek didn't have.
Isn't
specifically F and G, which were clearly taken from the Latin alphabet.
Right.
And there's possibly a runic character to represent, to distinguish between the consonant W sound and the vowel U, rather than using U for both. Mm-hmm. That may have been based on a rune, but it's not clear. So that's speculation. It's not certain where it comes from, but that's one possibility. So a small runic connection there, but it's just interesting that there was this whole writing system invented for a Germanic language that consciously avoided runes. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
All right. Well, that was a lot, actually. You'd said you didn't have very much to talk about, but that was actually a lot. So I might kind of, okay, I'm going to cut out some of what I was going to talk about. However, if you've made it this far into the podcast, dear Wombat, our good friend Michael, just earlier today happened to tweet, I wonder where the alphabet order comes from. You know, is it just random or where does it come from? And I don't want to go into too much detail about alphabets because we will get to that when we get to spelling. So we pointed him to our spelling video. And
that will become a podcast.
That will become a podcast, but not yet.
Not yet.
So I promised that we'd talk a little bit about it on our podcast. And then I do have a couple of other little things I want to talk about. Because we talked about the Futhark order, mm-hmm. right? And then all of that and how it's connected to the alphabet order. So very briefly, I want to talk a little bit about the Greek alphabet,
right?
The early Greek alphabet, because it influenced the Latin. You know, when you talk about the Italic alphabet as opposed to the Greek, yes, but of course the Italic alphabet is derived from the Greek alphabet. All of the alphabets in Europe are, including the runic alphabet, are derived eventually from the Greek alphabet.
But it, they didn't have itself, it first.
So yeah, but it itself, of course, is derived from a Phoenician mm-hmm. alphabet, which, as you talk about in spelling, is itself derived from an Egyptian, not alphabet, but from Egyptian hieroglyphic writing.
Well, before that, there was another group of Semitic peoples
yes.
who weren't the Phoenicians, but it was a language fairly close to Phoenician.
Right. So another Semitic people who took hieroglyphs.
Yeah. Some of whom were in Egypt, mm-hmm. who worked as miners, apparently. And that's where we first see it attested.
Right. So if we're talking about where the order is, this is something we should look up for when we do talk about spelling, is we should look more into the order, because I don't think you went into why it is the order it is.
Yeah.
And I'm not sure there is an answer to that. But what is something that I will say is, so what happens is the Semitic alphabet draws on Egyptian hieroglyphs and basically does this thing of whatever the word the hieroglyph represents, it takes the first letter and makes that symbol now stand for just that letter, and that's how it becomes alphabetic.
It was already being done that way
in Egyptian
to write out names specifically.
Right, right. And so that they sort of extend that practice to mm-hmm. all writing. Then that by the time it cuts to Phoenician and it, all through the Semitic alphabets, they're not really alphabets, they're abjads. They only have consonants.
Yeah.
They don't write out the vowels because the rules of Semitic languages make vowels, I don't really know the details, but moderately predictable, I think, is sort of the basic, right?
Yeah. Well, what happens is you change the vowels to change something grammatically about the word.
Yeah. You'd still
so you have the same root.
I know. You'd still think you'd want to write that out. I find it baffling, but I've never taken a Semitic language like, yes. And that's why we write down ED on the end of our verbs so that we can tell it's in the past tense. How do you read a sentence if you don't know what tense it? Anyway, obviously I need to learn, you know, this is still how Arabic is written and Hebrew and stuff. So like clearly people can make it work because
well,
they do.
Now
they use points and stuff, but you don't need to. No. For generations and millennia, they didn't.
Make it easier.
Yeah. Anyway, the point being that Semitic didn't have signs for vowels. Mm-hmm. So just moving on to what I know a little more about, which is how the Greek alphabet moves. We don't know the details, and this is disputed too. You know, how did it get from Phoenicia to Greece? That's undisputed. But when and how? Mm-hmm. No.
We know the Phoenicians were.
Oh, there's not it's not hard
so there was
to understand.
Definitely contact
there, we know there's lots of contact, but like
what exactly when,
where, when, in what particular, like why was it first taken over? What was the first purpose of it?
Right.
Our best guess right now seems to be sometime in the 800s BCE.
Okay.
And probably in like Cyprus or Crete or in Asia Minor, just because of those big trading hubs.
Right.
But that's not because we know of it. I mean,
it
people make different arguments.
Sense,
it makes logical sense. The Greeks themselves knew it was Phoenician. They reference it. So Herodotus, for instance, says that he gives us the story of Cadmus, and this comes elsewhere too. I'll get back to that. But the term Phoenicia, which means Phoenician things, is used for letters in early Greek writing and in inscriptions. And archaic Crete has an inscription that has Poinikastas to mean scribe and Poinikadzein to write. So to do Phoenician things means to write. Mm. So, you know, they very clearly saw it as and knew it as Phoenician in their earliest incorporations of it into Greek. The big thing so to get back to the order of the alphabet thing here, mm-hmm. the big thing is, as you know, I mean, this is, I'm not mm-hmm. telling you anything you don't know, but that the Greek language did want to represent vowels And so they repurposed a bunch of consonants they didn't have.
Yeah, fortunately,
Phoenician had more consonantal sounds.
Had a whole
sounds.
Bunch of you know, very similar consonants that were distinctions that Greek didn't make. So there was a whole bunch of different versions of the K sound.
Yeah, for instance. So they were able to use, so there were a number of signs that mm-hmm. made sounds that weren't different from another sound for Greek mm-hmm. purposes. And so they used those and they just turned them into vowels.
Yeah.
Often from the name, mm-hmm. again, from the first letter that had been, or first, you know, one of the sounds, and then sometimes just seemingly randomly. This is one of the questions is like, was there only one or were there many adoptions? And it really seems to have been one, like one person or group did this and it spread, because while there's a few variations in early alphabets in Greece, not very many. That's and in particular, the vowel, which vowels got adopted, doesn't seem to have variations.
Wow. Okay, yeah, that's what where you would expect.
Yeah, and that's because those are the ones. Whereas there's a couple of consonants that sort of seem to switch around a little bit, like some psi and a xi, I think, sort of alternate in a couple of early scripts. But the vowels don't. So that really does suggest that it was one borrowing, because those are fairly, not completely arbitrary, but somewhat arbitrary. So the order stuck to the Semitic order, pretty much. What happens then is the Greek, some of the repurposed consonants, though, get stuck on the end. So there, some of it's not arbitrary in the sense that they put new invented letters onto
on the
end.
End.
They didn't stick them in
they
the middle.
They didn't want to break up the already existing
order.
Yeah,
so there was an order, clearly, and why there was that order and why this, you know, so the earliest evidence we have for that order, I think, is Semitic, I'm pretty sure. So, you know, that is still a question. But so there is some reasoning to the order at that stage. That's really all I wanted to say to try to answer Michael's question. Okay. I mean, that's not a full answer at all.
Yeah, I think we'd have to look to Egyptian. Really,
yeah,
to
really
see.
Try to understand. But I mean, because they didn't have an alphabet, I don't know that, like, was there an order to, you wouldn't have had an order to the hieroglyphs in the same way.
You didn't use just any hieroglyph to do.
I know.
There were certain ones that were used, and I don't know if they were ever written out as a set.
Well, that's what
but they were certainly considered as a set.
Yeah, so maybe we'd have to look for that. So maybe we'll look into that.
Mm-hmm.
So I mentioned Cadmus, and just to touch on that, there's this myth. So, you know, the Greeks were well aware there was a time before they had writing and then the time after they had writing. So the myth is that Cadmus, who's the founder of Thebes, was an exile from Phoenicia. He's the brother of Europa, the girl who was abducted by Zeus in the shape of a bull and carried from Phoenicia to Europe, giving her name to Europe. And her brothers were sent out by their father to find her and told not to come back if they didn't. And they didn't, because, like, Zeus. So Cadmus couldn't go back, so he ends up going to the oracle at Delphi and asking what to do, and they're like, go found a city where a heifer lies down to drink. Anyway, doesn't matter. The point is, he founds Thebes, and he is said to have been the inventor of the alphabet, or to have brought the alphabet from Phoenicia. Now, there's other versions of it where it's Prometheus, because he's the giver of technology. So there are other stories in which it's Prometheus, but that's just clearly like he gives all of the important technologies.
Yeah.
But the one that links it to Cadmus is not because Thebes was the early literate city.
Right.
It's because he's Phoenician and all the stories make him Phoenician.
Right.
And so they, because they know
they
it comes
know
from
Phoenicia. So
that must have been that. So that's the alphabet in Greece. The argument about why they started using it is interesting, because, like, why decide to start writing things down? Not everybody is in that time. And there are two competing arguments, and there's good evidence on both sides, but I don't know that we'll ever know. One argument is that it was specifically picked up in order to write epic poetry.
Really?
Yeah. Remember, writing was used for that. Cuneiform more in the cultures that the Greeks knew and that they were definitely influenced by. So they were influenced by Sumerian and Mesopotamian cultures for their myths, we can tell that. So they would have had experience at some point of this idea of writing long epic poems, writing them down. Now, I don't know that the Semitic language was being used for those purposes at the time, but knowing there was a way of writing, that this was a way of recording poetry, and then finding an alphabet that seemed better and way easier than cuneiform and more easily adapted to Greek, that might have been why.
I would have thought it was like trade.
Well, so that's obviously the other argument is that it was first adopted for commercial purposes. And the, you know, good evidence for that is that the people they were adopting it from are their trading partners.
Yeah.
And presumably they were using it for commercial purposes, the Phoenicians, that is.
Yeah.
The thing is that all of our early writing is not commercial.
Well, I guess,
but of course, why would it survive, yeah, right?
If it's like a list of the cargo on a ship, who would say that?
So that's the argument, that's the counter argument, is that, well, why would that survive? That's going to be written in perishable materials. What survives is stuff that's, but what survives?
Well, and more importantly, why would you recopy it, right?
Oh, no, but none of the early stuff.
Epic is not the original copies.
But none of what I'm talking about is stuff that was recopied. We're talking about inscriptions. What are the earliest inscriptions?
Oh, okay. Right.
Like the earliest actual writing. So the extant writing we have from the 8th century and the 7th century is all popular. That is like not elite. It's sort of like, I mean, probably to some extent elite, but not just for, like, not royal letters, right? Not like, because that's what, of course, cuneiform is special because its main medium was clay tablets, which then survive.
Yeah.
So that's why we have so much of it. But all of the extant writing is private and it's not commercial or administrative. We don't have administrative examples of inscriptions until into the 7th century.
And it's not monumental.
No, and it's not monumental. The first known, one of the first known inscriptions, one of the earliest, not the earliest, but one of the earliest inscriptions we have, and a lot of the ones that we have that are early are in hexameter. So they're in verse.
Okay.
Even if they're not epic, like what we don't have inscriptions on stone of epic or anything like that. But like, even if they're 2-line or 4-line poems, they're in hexameter, which is the meter of the early epics, of early poetry. So like, we have poetic scraps, but we don't have any admin scraps. Mm. These are arguments from slight evidence, and there's lots of ways you can poke holes in them, but it's interesting. So one of the earliest inscriptions we have is actually on a cup. So it's scratched into and baked into a pottery cup. Mm-hmm. And there's a little bit of a problem with one rather important part of the first line, but I'm going to read the generally accepted restoration.
Okay.
And I'll talk about what it is. It's from the late 8th century. So, you know, 780s or something like that.
That's BCE.
BCE, yep. And it's from the Bay of Naples. So that's in Italy.
Right.
Right? So when we're talking about, like, that's how far and fast the alphabet spread. Because we're saying that it's the 8th century is when it's the first inscriptions we have, the first evidence we have of it is in the mid-8th century. And by the late 8th century, it's in southern Italy.
Yeah.
Which is, of course, a very important Greek area.
That just makes me think. I don't think I was previously aware of how early there were Greek settlements in Italy.
Yeah, it's in the 8th century is a big period of colonization, 8th and 7th, but especially the 8th. And so a lot of the southern Italian cities were founded then, and even Marseille and Sicily. Like, Sicily was a huge Greek area from the 8th century onward. So, yeah, it's one thinks about those as, you know, Roman, but no, they're very big Greek areas. So the inscription reads, "I am the cup of Nestor, good for drinking. Whoever drinks from this cup, desire for beautifully crowned Aphrodite will seize him instantly."
So is this the Nestor?
Well, isn't that an interesting question? So it's in hexameters. Uh-huh. So it's in epic meter. Mm-hmm. And Nestor, of course, is a famous name from the Iliad. Mm-hmm. And the problem is, one of the bits that's least clear is the part where it says, "I am." There's a few possible readings there. Now, the "I am" is reasonably secure because there's a lot of items in the Greek world that have that speak like that say, "I am made by so-and-so.
That's what runic inscriptions very often do.
Yeah. So it would be very common for it to say, "I am the cup of Nestor," but does it mean it was made by Nestor? Does it mean it's owned by Nestor? Is this just a guy named Nestor? But it seems so hard to be. Yeah, exactly. But sort of like, but this is like in hexameters. Lots and lots have been written on this. I read one article that was interesting, and I'll link in the show notes, that suggested that it has magical properties to it, actually.
Well, it seems to be an aphrodisiac, I guess.
Well, so this is it. So a lot of people have just said all it's saying is, if you drink wine from this cup, because obviously that's what it's made for, you'll want sex.
Yeah.
Because wine is an intoxicant and makes you want to have sex.
Right.
This was actually arguing that it's a little more direct than that. It's saying this cup is magical specifically. And it was arguing from the sort of syntax of sort of conditional curses, which are quite standard. If someone steals this, he will be struck blind, right? Like that, whoever steals this, he will be struck blind. Whoever disturbs this stone, let him be cursed by Zeus.
Whoever drinks from this
cup, he will be seized. Yeah, so the argument was really from that. And it was also arguing, quite rightly, that saying you're going to be seized by Aphrodite is not a promise, it's a threat. Yeah. The Greeks and the Romans thought of sort of lust as being kind of a madness, a pain and a madness that would drive you out of your wits. So like we might think of it as like, haha, an aphrodisiac, but it could also be taken as, or possibly as a joking curse, but still as sort of like, careful what you do with me, I might drive you to lust.
Sort of like Paris and Helen in the Iliad.
Oh, yeah. Well, think about love stories in Greek myth and find me one in which the love does something good to the people in love. And get back to me on that one.
I mean, Helen's always talking about how she despises Aphrodite keeps making her.
Love of the kind that Aphrodite inspires, as opposed to like marital love or family love, it's a destructive force. So anyway, I thought that was really interesting. So that's like one of our earliest inscriptions in the Greek alphabet is that cup. So you can see why people have made the argument that it doesn't feel like they learned this special new skill so that they could like keep accounts.
Right.
But all of the caveats apply. Okay, a couple of things. Of course, the alphabet's not the first way that Greek is recorded. The first one we know is recording Greek is Linear B. So the earliest texts that we have recorded in the geographical area known as Greece are in a family of scripts in Crete. They've been labeled by Sir Arthur Evans Cretan pictographic, Cretan hieroglyphic, Linear A, and Linear B. Now, the first three of those are undeciphered, and it's unclear what language they represent. They probably don't represent Greek because we don't think that the Minoans were a Greek people.
Right.
But we don't know. So those exist, but we do know Linear B. So Linear B was undeciphered until the 20th century, but Michael Ventris, who was building on work by the classicist Alice Kober, who never gets credit, so I'm just going to make sure she does now, and using tablets that had been discovered by Sir Arthur Evans, and then also, importantly, another cache that had been discovered by another archaeologist, Carl Blagan, and photographed, and he was working with the photographs, by Alison France. He, in 1952, Michael Ventris managed to decipher Linear B for the first time.
Right.
Using sort of code-breaking techniques, but also building, as I said, on Alice Kober had done the very important work of sort of suggesting this was syllabic. Well, parts that were syllabic and parts that were alphabetic and like, it's mostly syllabic. Anyway, and she'd done work on figuring out that there were inflections.
Right.
And so once, like that helped a lot, and then he built this sort of like table of inflections and figured stuff out and started to do it and finally did manage to decipher it. And when he deciphered it, he proved that the language it represented was early Greek.
Right.
Which was a huge deal because nobody had thought that the Minoans were Greek. We've gone on to feel like that they weren't, and this was Mycenaean influence on late Minoan culture. So we have Linear B, and that is a syllabic rather than alphabetic. It's sort of a bunch of things. It has numerals. It has hieroglyphic or pictographic elements, so like things that represent things.
Right.
Sort of simplified versions of cows and sheaves of wheat and stuff like that. And then it has the syllabic stuff.
Yeah, and that's not unprecedented. You know, the Chinese script mixes.
Yeah, it makes sense. Like some things are easily represented by pictographs. Yeah. Why wouldn't you represent them by pictographs? Especially because, so in contrast to early Greek alphabet, Linear B, what we have, now, of course, what we have is stuff that was inscribed on clay that was accidentally preserved when things burned down.
Right.
So what we have is probably the stuff that was not meant to last, but happened to last. And the stuff that probably was meant to last, if it was written on things like papyrus, didn't survive. So we don't know that Linear B wasn't used for other purposes, but we don't have any inscriptions or monumental inscriptions like we do for cuneiform or for, you know, other things. All we have is the Linear B tablets are all administrative.
Okay.
So it's inventories, it's lists of taxes, it's lists of expenditures by temples. It's all bureaucratic.
I've got all those numbers.
Which is why we have numbers and why we have lists, you know, these images. So like, yeah, if you're going to tally up a whole bunch of cows and jars of wine and all the rest of it, pictographs are perfectly good for that. You don't need anything else for it. And then the words that are more complicated, they develop a syllabary for it. That was part of what made it hard to figure out what language it represented. And that's why like the pictographs and hieroglyphics, we don't know what language it represents because we don't have any sound.
Right.
So the syllabary was the important, figuring out that part of it was a syllabary was really important. And then being able to assign sounds to that and figure out how it worked was the key.
Right.
So anyway, but that writing system seems to have disappeared around 1100 BCE, or certainly by the turn of the millennium, was gone. And when they started writing again.
Now, that was that's the Bronze Age collapse?
Yeah. Yeah. So that was the Mycenaean peoples in Greece who were writing with that. And then, yes, there's this somewhat mysterious, catastrophic collapse of civilizations around the Mediterranean. Anyway, there's so much argument about that. I'm not going to start talking about that.
Sea peoples.
Well, but if it even happened, anyway, let's not get into that. So that technology was lost.
Right.
And when they come back to it, they come from a totally different direction. They go with an alphabet from Phoenicia. And B, potentially anyway, they use it for a completely different purpose.
Right.
So its role in the civilization is not the same.
Right.
Too. So that's the earliest scripts. And then the last thing I'll talk very briefly about is our earliest evidence of writing, which obviously is in a written script, but Homer talks about or mentions writing.
Right.
And the thing about Homer is, while of course it comes down to us in a written form, it is now good accepted fact that the composition of the poem was pre-literate, right? And so it was being composed in a society that didn't generally have writing. So to some extent, you wouldn't expect any mention of writing in it. Mm-hmm. And we don't have mention of it really in like the idea of writing down an epic or anything like that. There's no idea of literacy in that sense. So there's one passage that does have elements of writing, maybe. So it's Iliad book 6, and it's in the middle of a complicated thing where Glaucus and Diomedes exchange armor. It's an important scene. As part of this, they kind of exchange pedigrees and they end up finding out that they are guest friends by family connection. And that's why, so they won't fight each other. So they exchange armor to mark that. In the background of it, Glaucus, the Trojan, tells the story of his family, and he tells the story of one of his ancestors who's Bellerophon. Bellerophon is famous elsewhere for having tamed Pegasus and fought the Chimera. But the beginning of this has a story that is known as the Potiphar's wife motif, after the similar story in the Bible, and I'll come back to that. Basically, the king of the country has a young queen who falls in love with Bellerophon. He rejects her. She accuses him of rape. And so Proteus wants to get rid of Bellerophon, but he's scared of him or doesn't want to do it himself. So he stopped short of putting Bellerophon to death. It was a thing he dared not do. But he packed him off to Lycia. So they're in a place in Greece is where they're starting off. But he packs him off to Lycia. So that's Asia Minor. Mm. And that's important. With sinister credentials from himself, he gave him a folded tablet on which he had traced a number of devices with a deadly meaning and told him to hand this to his father-in-law, the Lycian king, and thus ensure his own death. So Bellerophon goes. When he reaches there, he's welcomed as an honored guest. But on the 10th day, he examined him and asked to see his credentials. When he had deciphered the fatal message from his son-in-law, the king then tried to kill him by sending him off to kill a monster. Okay, the rest of it's not important. He survives, in case you're worried. So what are those fatal signs, right? Mm-hmm. They don't have to be writing. They certainly don't have to be alphabetic writing. But a folded tablet, I mean, that is exactly how writing was done later. And the words that are used are, in the Greek, they're semata lugra, so semata signs. Mm-hmm. And that is a word that is used later for writing. So it could be. So the passage has been, this I'm reading from an article, the passage has been explained away as a dim memory of Mycenaean script or a reference to some primitive system of signing tokens or pictograms. Yet recent finds from the Near East convincingly suggest that the writing here is Oriental writing, as are the motifs and geography of the story. And I think that's a really interesting point. So that motif, it's called the Potiphar's wife thing from the story of Joseph.
Right.
Where the same thing happens to Joseph when he's in Egypt. His supervisor's wife falls in love with him, right?
Yeah.
And it's exactly the same, that part of it's the same story. It turns up elsewhere, of course. But there's a Semitic connection to that story. And we know there's lots of Semitic connections, but specifically Semitic. And he's sent to Lycia, which is in Asia Minor. So in the Oriental, in the terms of that article, it's an old term, but in the Near Eastern context. So the idea that that story would be in that context, in the geography, with that motif, and include an understanding of writing that is a Semitic understanding of writing that comes from the Phoenician or some other, seems very probable. I mean, can't prove it, but
so
it seems
could have been borrowed from.
So it could be that the whole story is borrowed, and therefore the concept of writing in it that Homer doesn't know what the writing is, right, but has borrowed the story with this idea in it, mm-hmm, from this. And so just calls them deadly signs because they don't know what they are. Or that it's an understanding of Semitic writing that they don't, they still only use in these tiny little isolated ways that like a king might use to send a message to another king, but ordinary folk aren't using and so wouldn't know. So anyways, it's just it's the only mention of writing, if it is a mention of writing, in Homer.
Can they, because I know to some degree you can date bits of Homer as early
don't even. What are you, some kind of analyst? I mean, I don't know. Short answer. And this article is trying to make some arguments about stuff and doesn't appeal to an argument from dating the section. So right. I'm not gonna say. I don't know. question of Homeric composition and dates thereof. Don't even want to talk about it. But, you know, it is interesting because, of course, Homer is being written down around the same time. Mm-hmm. Like, our dates for when is Homer written down are generally considered to be 8th century to 6th century. The alphabet comes in about the same time as some fairly reasonable dates for when Homer is first written down. I think these days people are leaning more towards a later date for writing down, towards the 7th and 6th centuries. So the argument isn't maybe as strong. You know, the idea that we get the alphabet and we get Homer being written down pretty much at the same time was a big part of the argument for that being the reason.
Right.
I don't know that that's quite as accepted now, but I mean, when you talk about the date of Homer, there's no such thing as accepted. So right, it's not wildly off. Let's put it that way.
It's interesting that you mentioned this. It suddenly made me think of Beowulf, which also doesn't have any mention
of
writing, except when, so after Beowulf kills Grendel's mother, mm-hmm, he uses this magic sword that he found there in her lair, underwater lair. And the blade of the sword melts away with her blood.
Right.
But he's left with the sword hilt, which he brings back to the court of Hrothgar. And it's not made it clear exactly what it is, but there's some kind of markings on the sword hilt that tell a story that they're not able to really understand.
Huh.
It's not clear if these are pictures.
Right. I mean, that doesn't have to be writing, of course.
Writing, mm-hmm, it's very vague.
And if it is writing, they don't understand it. So again, it might be some kind of vague understanding of writing by a non-literate person.
Yeah. Now, of course, that there's all depends on question. The dating of Beowulf.
And there's the whole question of like Virgilian influence on Beowulf and stuff, which would obviously suggest a literate. But again, Beowulf the story is older than Beowulf the poem.
Yeah.
You know, so, Beowulf the poem is
older. Who knows what you can make out of that. But anyways, there is that nice parallel there. So
yeah, no, interesting. Okay, and then I have one last little tidbit to end with, which is just a fun little myth about writing, which is that there is a flower that has letters on it in Greek myth. Well, fun. It's not a fun myth. There's death in it. They all have death in them. There is a myth about a young boy, young Spartan prince called Hyacinthos, who is beloved of Apollo and of the wind Zephyros. So these two gods both love him because he's beautiful. And so Zephyros is jealous because Apollo is winning. And so Apollo and Hyacinthos are playing a game one day, maybe discus, maybe something else, some kind of throwing game. And Zephyr uses a gust of his wind to blow the disc off course and hit Hyacinth and kill him. Because, of course, when you're jealous, you kill the person you love.
Right.
Because that's Greek myth.
Well, he couldn't kill the gods. So
well, indeed.
What is he going to do?
So as Hyacinth lay dying, Apollo was so sad that he caused a flower to grow out of his blood. Mm-hmm. And the flower is inscribed with the Greek words ai, alas, alas, mm-hmm, ai, ai. That's, of course, the hyacinth flower. Right. However, it's not the hyacinth flower that we think of.
Is that the same species?
No, it's not the same species. Probably the larkspur or the iris. And I will put a link to this story on theoi.com. And they have a picture of a larkspur and they have it like written with the letters written beside it, the alpha and the iota, to try to show you sort of how it works. I'm not certain about that. But anyway, but the interesting thing is there's another version of that story, which says that that's not where that. So there seems to be a plant that they definitely think has the letters AI on it, because it's either named after Hyacinth or it's another flower, or the larkspur flower, that has the AI, because when Ajax, the Greek hero, whose name in Greek is Aias, A-I-A-S, when he killed himself after being denied the armor of Achilles, after Trojan War, it's a big, long, complicated story, but he kills himself, that the flower sprang from his blood and it has his letters on it, AI, just of his name. So two different myths explaining this Alpha Iota. So clearly they definitely thought there was a flower that looked like an AI. I don't really see it in the Larkspur that shows it, but whatever. So I just think it's interesting, though, because, you know, these are old myths then, mm-hmm. but they can't be that old if they suggest there's alphabetic letters on the flowers.
Presumably. So that story about Ajax would have been in the epic cycle.
I mean, the story about Ajax is in the epic, cycle.
Him wanting the armor and...
Oh, yeah, that's all in... We know that is from the Odyssey and like it's there early, but the detail that a flower sprang from his blood, there's no particular reason to think that was in an early version. It's not in the Odyssey, for instance.
Right.
So who knows when that gets added, right? We only know it from Ovid, right?
Yes.
So it could be God knows when it comes along. So anyway, and same with the Hyacinth story is all in late authors too, Ovid and Pausanias and Philostratus. So, you know, could have come at any time,
right.
but it's still interesting to find a myth that actually has letters like that.
Right.
And that is everything I have to say for the moment about early writing in Greece.
Well, I'll just add, since you mentioned myths about the creation of writing, there is a Norse myth about Odin inventing
runes. Right.
So it's mentioned briefly in several sources about him inventing runes. And there's one sort of long passage in the Havamal about Odin gaining the knowledge of runes by sacrificing himself to himself, because, of course, he's the god of death. So when you sacrifice someone, you sacrifice them to Odin. So he has to sacrifice himself to himself by hanging himself from a mighty tree, which is probably Yggdrasil, and piercing himself with a fearsome spear, probably Gungnir, his spear. And, you know, there's a description of the sort of pain and suffering of this process. He wants wisdom, and he does all these, he sacrifices an eye.
Yeah, to he get does all these things all these to get things. It, yeah.
Yeah. And so this is one of the things he does, and from this he gets the knowledge of runes. And there may be even a reference to this same idea even in Old English, because there are two Old English texts that talk about the invention of runes by Mercury the Giant.
Who would, of course, be the analog for Odin.
Odin.
Yeah. And then, I mean, that as I suppose a piece of evidence or a suggestion that there might be magical elements to runes themselves.
Yeah.
Right. That he has to learn it in this really complicated and sort of magical way. And Odin is associated with magic in lots of ways.
So if you still want more about runes, there is actually a lot more to know. But I am probably not the one to tell you more. You should go to an expert, a runologist. And there is, in fact, a podcast just for that.
Right.
It's called The Runecast.
Which is a good pun, right?
Yes.
Because casting the runes.
Casting the runes.
Yeah.
I listened to it. It's really interesting. It goes into lots of detail. So check that out.
Right. And we'll put a link to that, of course. Right. Well, I hope that has been a nice distraction from the world. As I said, I'd love to say that we're going to be pumping these out, but we're not. I don't even know when this is going to come out. As I said, we're recording on the 31st, though it is now first.
Yes.
Because we've gone over midnight by quite a long time. So I have to now edit it and get it out. So I'm not quite sure how quickly that'll be. I'll try to do it quickly.
But you in the future know exactly when it is.
Yes, you do. So we didn't really get a podcast out in March. This counts as our March one, but maybe we'll get another one out in April.
I hope so.
You never know.
We'll see.
Maybe we'll interview somebody else who's also isolated at home. Closest to social interaction we're going to get. So we might as well do it. All right. Be well, everyone. Stay safe. We are thinking of everyone. And please do come and visit us on Lyceum and chat if you're looking for something to do. We'd love to talk about this episode or any others.
Oh gosh, we have to think of a discussion topic. Quick.
Would you like to be hung from a tree to learn about runes? No, let's not do that. All right. Thanks for listening.
Bye-bye.
For more information on this podcast, check out our website, www.alliterative.net, where you can find links to the videos, blog posts, sources, and credits, and all our contact info.
And please check out our Patreon, where you can pledge to support this show and our video project. You can go directly to the videos at youtube.com/alliterative.
Our email is on the website, but the easiest way to get in touch with us is Twitter. I'm at AvenSarah, AvenSarah.
And I'm at Alliterative. To keep up with the podcast, subscribe on your favorite podcast app or to the feed on the website.
And if you've enjoyed it, consider leaving us a review on Apple Podcasts or wherever you listen. It helps us a lot. We'll be back soon with more musings about the connections around us. Thanks for listening.
Bye.